Good morning, everyone. I would like to talk about testing MHD theory around supermassive black holes. In this talk, it's not a review talk, it's a very focused talk, and I would like to focus on one particular, very special supermassive black hole in a massive elliptical galaxy called M87. And I will be talking about modeling polarized radiative transfer through GR-MHD simulations, and about modeling various observables that will allow us to actually test the theory. And this work is done in collaboration with Jason Dexter, that we'll talk later today, and also with my master's student Jordi and Heino Falke, who is my boss. So first, a few facts about M87. So M87 is a massive elliptical galaxy in the Virgo cluster. It's at a distance of 16 megaparsecs. The mass of the supermassive black hole in its center, it's about 6 × 10⁹ solar masses. M87 core, it's typical low luminosity AGN. Its bolometric luminosity is at the level of about 10⁻⁶ Eddington luminosities. This core also is known for to display this powerful jet. This is a FR1 type of jet. From LOFAR observations, we know that this jet is pretty powerful, 10⁴⁵ ergs per second. And also from the observations of the jet, of knots moving along the jet, we also have some idea about the viewing angle of the orientation of this system with respect to the line of sight. It's about 20 degrees, where 0 degrees would correspond to looking along the jet. This source is basically nicely resolved by radio observations up to 43 gigahertz. Above these frequencies, basically the source is not yet resolved well within central milli-arc second. This is actually where we do have predictions from GR-MHD models. So all the GR-MHD models are basically well within this central milli-arc second. And near future millimeter VLBI observations with the Event Horizon Telescope will basically try to resolve this central region. So the Event Horizon Telescope resolution is related to the longest baseline of the interferometric network and the observing wavelength. And the resolution is about 30 micro arc seconds. And this is basically, this number is smaller than the expected apparent size of the event horizon of the supermassive black hole. So this is a very unique source where we actually can test MHD theory of accretion and jet formation and disk jet symbiosis on all scales from kiloparsecs through 100 Schwarzschilds all the way down to the event horizon. So I'm not going to talk about the details of these observations. I think Jason will talk about this later. I'm going to go straight to the modeling. So before GR-MHD simulations, I would like to quickly show this nice sketch figure from the review paper by Lewis Holt from 2008. So this is what we think is going on in the low luminosity AGN, also in M87. So there is some kind of accretion disk around the black hole. And because of very low accretion rate, the inner portion of this disk is basically puffed to this geometrically thick and optically thick torus. This torus basically plays some crucial role in collimating the jets. And this torus is radiating inefficiently, so there's a little bit light produced, and this light does not affect the dynamics of plasma. So in some sense, it's much easier to model this kind of sources. It's more feasible computationally. because we can decouple dynamics of plasma from radiative transfer. And we can do radiative transfer as a post-processing modeling. So this is basically a GRMHD realization of this idea. This is one particular model. This is ideal MHD simulation, one snapshot. This is three-dimensional model. This kind of simulation in a current jargon is called SANE simulation, which is standard and normal evolution. There are some other models, of course, like MAD models, magnetically arrested disks, for example. In the SANE models, we have accretion disk around the black hole that is geometrically thick and optically thin, and the disk is turbulent. This turbulence is driven initially by the magnetorotational instability. This kind of disks are also known to produce magnetized outflows, winds, and the most magnetized part of this wind, we associate this with a jet. By assumption, we are modeling accretion disk with a very low accretion rate. So this plasma in accretion disk is very diluted, and this is basically means that it's collisionless plasma, and it's probably to temperature. So this theory is advancing, and Sasha was talking about this. There are some more detailed calculations of these two temperature plasmas. I am using this kind of phenomenological formula and basically assume something about proton-to-electron temperatures. And this is my law. So I basically assume that the proton-to-electron temperature is some function of beta plasma parameter, where beta is a gas pressure to magnetic pressure ratio. And I have two free parameters here. R high is the coupling between these two species in a high beta regions, which means in accretion disk, more or less. And R low is the ratio of these temperatures in low beta regions, which means more or less in a jet. And what I do, I basically carry out many radiative transfer simulations and try to determine what are those two free parameters by fitting my models to the observations of this source. So I'm going around this difficult problem. Okay, so just to keep you even more focused, what I will be showing will be models of millimeter emission. So EHT, Event Horizon Telescope, operates at this 230 gigahertz frequency. I also model a little bit lower radio energies to model observations from GMVA or radio VLBI. The dominant cooling process around this wavelength or frequencies is the synchrotron emission, because of course this is a relativistically hot magnetized plasma, and I am modeling emission from very close to the event horizon. So keep in mind that whatever images I will show you, they are very distorted by two effects. Doppler boost, the plasma is moving very fast around the black hole, and they will be also very much distorted by the gravitational lensing. And the goal of this is to basically constrain the model free parameters by fitting the model to observations. So for example, this proton-electron coupling ratios, or for example, the mass accretion rate onto the black hole. So in this talk, I will focus on these two points. And in the future, of course, when we get data from the Event Horizon Telescope, we also would like to find out, for example, what is the spin of the central black hole in M87, or for example, find out what is the geometry of the magnetic fields in accretion disk or jet near the event horizon. Okay, so this is my model number one. This is a disk emission dominated model. So in this model, I basically assume that the coupling ratio between protons and electrons is same, it's one. In highly magnetized regions and low magnetized regions, so TP over TE is one everywhere. So this is what the electron temperatures you're getting. This is electron temperature in electron rest mass units, and this is how this model looks like at the EHT frequency and at some radio frequency. So this dark circle here, this is the shadow of the black hole, and this is how the disk image looks like at this frequency. Maybe you already noticed that if you look at lower energies, these models basically do not nicely extend into this nice jet that we, two-arm jet that we observe in M87. One more thing to mention here is that in these models, the mass accretion rate onto the black hole is kind of low. My estimate is 10 to the minus 4 solar masses per year. So this is one part of a spectrum of models. So on the other side, we have those models where called jet emission dominated models. So in these models, I basically decouple protons and electrons in a disk. The coupling ratio is 100, and I leave them very strongly coupled in a highly magnetized region, which means in a jet, or rather along the jet wall, because the jet spine is basically evacuated here and it won't produce any radiation because there is no matter in there in this model. This is how the resulting electron temperature map looks like. And this is how this model will look like at the EHT frequency and the radio frequency. So one nice thing about this particular model is that if you look at the at 86 gigahertz, you start seeing this kind of nice two-arm structure that we actually observe in M87. So this it seems to me that this model would be better to describe M87. So here again, this black circle is the shadow of the black hole here and here. And the emission is basically entirely produced by this jet wall in both cases. And basically in this model, there is no emission from this turbulent accretion disk at all. And probably it's easier for you to identify what is producing this emission when I show you how this jet looks like from different angles, from different viewing angles. Okay. So this circle in here, this is not an accretion disk at the bottom of the jet. This is basically a counter jet that is strongly gravitationally lensed and looks sort of like a circle, but this is actually a counter jet. And this part is basically a forward jet. Okay, so this is how this, here I'm showing you how models look like. These are intensity maps, but synchrotron radiation that we are modeling is intrinsically polarized. It's in fact very highly polarized, even more than 75%. It really depends on the electron distribution function. So I have to do the polarized radiative transfer to see how this model looks like in the polarized light. So this is the set of the equations that we have to solve. So before I showed you how the models looks like only Stokes I, and now I will show you how they look like in this other Stokes parameters. So here you have some synchrotron emissivities, and here you have this mixing terms. So alpha is synchrotron self-absorptivity. Because we are modeling by assumption optically thin plasma, this alpha compared to J is pretty small. But there are also these terms rho here. This is basically Faraday rotation and Faraday conversion. And the problem is that this rho compared to alpha can be pretty large, 100 or even more. And this is what makes this set of equations stiff. So the plasma around the black hole in my models, it's optically thin, but at the same time, it's Faraday thick. And this is a big problem. It's difficult to solve these equations, not mentioning that we have to solve these equations in Kerr space times, right? So to solve the equation, I'm using this wonderful code, grtrans, that Jason wrote, that can actually handle this kind of situation. Okay, so this is my model number one. This is how it looks like. So here I'm showing you again the image at Event Horizon Telescope frequency. This is 230 gigahertz image. You can see a little more details here because I'm sort of like zooming in a little bit more to the black hole. So the gray scale is intensity, the synchrotron intensity. And the ticks basically show you the polarization structure of the model. So the color of the ticks basically indicates the linear polarization percentage. First thing to notice is that you can see that in this disk-dominated models, the structure of the image is very nicely organized. So you can see that the polarization structure is basically dominated by the toroidal component of the magnetic field in the accretion disk. And one more thing to mention is that basically the images are strongly polarized in most of the regions. And I also have a movie. This is how it looks like. So these structures are changing in time a little bit, but please keep in mind that M87 supermassive black hole is very massive, and the dynamical timescale at ISCO is about 10 hours or so. So the changes will be very, very slow. So the duration of this the entire movie is about a year. So from frame to frame here, it's about 4 days. So during one night of the observations, I don't think the structure of the image would change. It will, the time scale is much longer. And one can, of course, study this kind of images, the polarization, how the polarization structure in time, but we can already compare this model to the existing non-VLBI observations. So what is observed in the source? There are some single dish observations by Kuo et al. 2014, and they found out that in a non-VLBI observation at this particular frequencies, the source is totally depolarized to 1%. And this model predicts that if you do image integrated simulation, then this kind of image will be beam depolarized down to 5%. So it seems to me that this is not what we're going to see in M87 using the EHD observations. Here is this other model that fits better the radio observations of M87. This is the jet emission dominated model. So you can see that in polarized light, it's dramatically different compared to the previous slide. So first of all, this kind of jet dominated models have show much lower linear polarization. There are maybe some strongly polarized patches here and there, but overall, it's the linear polarization drops. In a non-VLBI observation, this kind of image will be being depolarized down to 1%. And this is exactly what we observe in M87 at 230 gigahertz. And here I can also show you a movie. This looks even more dramatic. So the grayscale again is the intensity. You can see maybe a little bit the shadow of the black hole. So this big circle is the emission from the counterjet, and you can see maybe a little bit more polarized emission from the forward jet. Okay, so in this model, there is basically not really any coherent signal of this TIC server is scrambled, and you may wonder why are they scrambled, because the magnetic fields in the jet are basically nicely organized into a nice spiral. It's not like they are turbulent. This is the reason are the Faraday effects. So basically here the Faraday effects, the Faraday rotation and Faraday conversion are basically totally scrambling the polarization structure, and not only polarization structure, but also the polarization percentage, the degree of the polarization. So here I'm showing you exactly the same model here by solving the full set of equations, and here for comparison when I turn off by hand the Faraday conversion and rotation. Okay, so, but so far we still don't have like a full data set from the EHT. EHT will observe M87 in April this year. What we can do, we can still compare, so we can at this moment compare this kind of models and test MHD theory by comparing these models to a non-VLBI observations that exist. So one example I already showed you, it's the linear polarization degree, but there's also another useful observable, which is basically the Faraday rotation that is detected in the source. So what's Faraday rotation? It's quantified by this Faraday rotation measure, and this is basically the change of the polarization angle, the total polarization angle, when observing the source at two closely spaced wavelengths divided by this wavelength square. And in fact, this rotation measure was basically detected in at least three systems with supermassive black holes. So one system is Sagittarius A star, but it also has been measured in M87. So in M87, the linear polarization at 230 gigahertz is 1%, and we have upper limit for the rotation measure. It's about, it's less than 7 × 10⁵ radians per meter square. So what do people do with this number? You can also express the rotation measure as this kind of integral along the line of sight, where you integrate the density of plasma along the line of sight times some magnetic field component parallel to the to your line of sight. And what you can do with this is you can assume some semi-analytical Ryab model of accretion flow. I'm losing my voice now. And you can basically, using this model, you can make some estimate about what is the accretion rate onto the black hole. So people have done this for Sagittarius A star and also for M87, and based on this Ryab models, they estimated that the mass accretion rate onto M87 has to be lower than 9 × 10⁴ solar masses per year. And maybe if you paid attention to what I was saying, this is already smaller than in this best model here, which has accretion rate 10 times more than this upper limit from observations. So the question is, should we limit our GRMHD free parameters with this kind of accretion rate constraints? And so first of all, the semi-analytical Ryab models that I use to basically estimate this accretion rate limit, they have no magnetic fields, there's zero magnetic fields in there, they have no jets, and they don't have any GR effect. And also they have the secret assumption that basically some polarized source is behind the Faraday screen, and the Faraday screen is Faraday thin. So that the polarization angle changes as a lambda square. And this relationship only was observed in Sagittarius A star and never been observed in M87. And the third argument is that we know what's the viewing angle of M87. It's 20 degrees, so we are looking at the source probably through some jet or some kind of outflowing wind. So why would we be measuring accretion rate in this source? So we decided to take our polarized radiative transfer models and actually calculate properly the rotation measure in the source. So this is the set of equations, and I take these images and I calculate the total Q and U Stokes parameters and calculate what is this total polarization angle that would be observed in non-VLBI observations, and we do that at two different wavelengths, and we can basically compare this model rotation measure to the observed one, and we can also compare that to this formula that is frequently used in the literature. Okay, so this is my last slide. So this is basically the main result. This is how the rotation measure looks like. As a function of accretion rate, or rather as a function of my model. So on the left-hand side, you have models where the disk emission dominates. They have low accretion rates. And on the right-hand side, you have those jet-dominated models, which have much higher accretion rates. And if you calculate things incorrectly using some approximate formulas, this is how the model rotation measure looks like, and it seems to me that you can, by mistake, discard many models that are still consistent with observations. So these blue points are basically rotation measures that are calculated properly, and it turned out that even if we assume very high accretion rates, the model is still consistent with the current observations. So this means that actually in M87, the accretion rate may be 10 or 100 times higher than it was thought until 2014. It can be, in fact, even higher than 10 to the minus 2 solar masses per year, because this rotation measure can be even constant, even if you start moving up the accretion rate, right? Okay, so here's my summary. So I showed you the first and the only existing GRMHD-based polarized images of M87 jet disk connection near event horizon. In a disk-dominated models, we have to assume low accretion rates. They always show very organized polarization patterns. They have a pretty high total linear polarization degree, which is inconsistent with the current observation. In the jet-dominated models that, by the way, nicely connect our GRMHD simulations to this large-scale jet that we see in this source, we have to assume much higher accretion rates, 100 times higher compared to these disk models. These models show very strong scrambling of polarization pattern. They also have much lower total linear polarization, and they are much more consistent with the current observations of this source. In the jet-dominated models, they will require accretion rates that are much higher than this previously limit of 9, 10 to the minus 4 solar masses per year. And they are actually consistent with the rotation measure limits if you calculate the rotation measure correctly. We can probably test these models even better once we get the event horizon telescope data. However, in the best models that we have now, we see jets, but we don't see the turbulent accretion disk. So maybe it will be difficult in this sense to test the accretion theory. And the second thing is that there is a lot of this polarization scrambling, and this is due to Faraday effects. And the question is, can we in this situation constrain the intrinsic geometry of the magnetic fields from the emission? This is a good question, and maybe the way to address it is when we model accretion flows, maybe we should not skip winds or jets. We should also model them together with accretion disk and try to resolve them also well. Okay, thank you very much.
I'm sure we have lots of questions. Wow. Definitely, from the program planning community, awesome.
So I'm gonna put my observer hat on now. They were really cool images. If you were to convolve them with the EHT beam, okay, can you test the models given that unfortunate limitation?
It's a very good question, and we are working on this. Yes, of course, there are some issues. You have to convolve this with instruments. Yeah, it's a very good question, yeah. I'm not able to answer it right now.
I hope so.
The polarization maps in particular are so different. I mean, even if you convolve it with the beam, you can measure the spatially resolved polarization.
Right, that's what the polarization may be the way to unlock it.
Those predictions should be quite different. I mean, even convolve with the beam, then you'll mix together these random Faraday rotated vectors that Monica was showing and, you know, decrease the level of polarization on small scales compared to in the other model.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's where I was going.
So this is a funnel wall jet, an accretion power jet.
So the power of the jet is about 10^43. Okay. So this jet is made of this wall, but there's also the spine, and the spine is more powerful than the wall.
So my question was about the energetics. Does it connect? Can you connect the energetics to the?
I don't know. Right. I don't know.
And the other question was, what spin did you assume?
It's standard spin 0.94 or something, but yeah, it's a good question.
Chris. So there's this magnetar that Neustar found, a near Sagittarius star.
Yeah.
And there's these Faraday polarization or Faraday rotation measures mm-hmm. of magnetic field in that part of the accretion flow, and if I remember correctly, it seems very strong there. And I know some of the magnetically dominated accretion people have used that as an argument that, you know, you've got low beta out at even at large radius, and so maybe that would affect
So
have you thoughts on that?
I didn't try Sagittarius A star. I mean, I think it's more complicated system than M87 in some sense, because you have the scattering screen and you see the lambda square behavior in polarization angles. So maybe Sagittarius A star does have this external Faraday screen on the top of this internal Faraday rotation. So yeah, you need something extra to actually model it. So.
Okay.
I haven't tried Sagittarius.
Monica, so one of the best constraints on M dot on Sagittarius A star is from rotation measure arguments. And you say that, you know, rotation measure, at least in some viewing angles or looking through the jets, is almost constant irrespective of M dot. Can it have implications for Sagittarius A star?
Yeah, so M87, again, it's simpler to model because we know what's the viewing angle, right? That it's low. In Sagittarius A star, there's no constraint on the viewing angle. So this may be also effect of the viewing angle. Yeah, and also you have to keep in mind that it's not like I'm showing you that Faraday rotation or rotation measure is constant as a function of M dot. It's not. It's just I'm showing you this models where they are basically constrained by the flux, constant flux, right? So, and in from disk models to jet models, I'm just shifting the emission region from the disk to the jet, and at the same time, I have to change the accretion rate, right? So I'm changing two parameters here at the same time, not just mass accretion rate. So.
Or in other words,
it's a little bit confusing, this plot. Yeah.
So if you look, you know, if you're viewing Sagittarius A star face on, should we be worried about the M dot constraint?
I think it's between 10^-9 to 10^-7. So I think this is there is a little bit more freedom in there. So I don't think that you have to worry about this.
Okay.
Can't be at the Bondi rate, right? No way.
10^-5, yeah, it's probably lower.
Just some points of clarification. So first of all, as far as the GRMHD is concerned, it's all one model.
It's just one model, yeah.
Okay, fine. I thought I heard you say just now that the jet and power was 10 to the 43 Hertz per second. But
in this model, yes. Yeah. So it does not really match the observational constraints from, for example, from low far observations. There's some a little bit offset.
It's like 10 to the 45 Hertz.
Yeah, but you know, low far sees these hotspots that are million years away, light years away from the core. The core may have changed. Since the jet puffed up the hotspots. So that's one idea. Or maybe the accretion rate in M87 is even higher than the one that I showed.
And then just the physics of this rotation measure and how it depends on the electron temperature. I don't remember quite how things go, but I would imagine that the synchrotron emission per particle would go as Lorentz factor squared, and the rotation measure would go as 1 over Lorentz factor. Is that properly taken into account?
We assume a thermal distribution for electrons.
Sure,
I don't even try. Yeah, they're relativistically hot. So yes, I think this result may be very sensitive to what we do we assume about electrons. And I just don't know how to accelerate particles in ideal MHD simulations yet. So yeah.
Faraday conversion.
Yes, there is Faraday conversion included, yes.
If you increase M dot too much, then you begin to have to include cooling in the GRMHD calculation.
Yeah.
So what would that limit be for solar masses per year? I'm not sure what that translates into.
It's a very good point to check again, I think. I haven't checked that because here it's kind of, it's not like a, like a standard GRMHD with cooling. You change this emission regions here. So I think one would have to just rerun the simulations and see how the cooling affects this hot jet. Maybe it will affect it at some point. I just have no. Yeah, but the problem is, does the cooling affect the dynamics of the system? So here I'm assuming that it won't, but maybe at some point you start radiating so much that the Ryaf assumption is not,
yeah,
it's not valid.
We know how much power, luminous power is coming out of that region, so I would think cooling would be less of an issue if you increase the mass accretion rate, get more energy. In the ions, but a fixed amount of luminosity coming out.
Yeah, so I think it will really depends on what do you assume about the dissipation of energy into electrons, because the electrons are radiating, right, not the protons. So, but I think this has to be checked, but
in some sense,
also...
It's another limit on M dot. I mean, as you say, you can't allow for cooling if you have too much flux. So, you know, it can't be cooling. That puts a limit on how...
Yeah, and also a good point to mention here is that this is just one set of models, right? The same simulations, this is very standard simulations. There are other models, like those MAD simulations, or you can assume different amount of flux in a disk at the beginning, and you may arrive in a slightly different solution. So, yeah, I think this is a lot of calculations I haven't tried yet, so.
So, can you show that slide with the two plots with Faraday rotation, polarization, and without the Faraday rotation?
This one?
No. The one that you had two images of the...
Ah, this one, okay.
Yeah, yes. So can you explain that? I can't find a connection that how the Faraday rotate... Well, I assume that the direction of the bars show the polarization angle, right?
Yes, exactly.
So I cannot see that how the Faraday effect changes the polarization angle such, I don't know, in a weird way. Like if you look at the two bars, somewhere in the middle, two has somehow the same polarization angle,
yes.
But one in the middle like becomes very...
Yes, so Faraday affects, we are solving the radiative transfer problem, so we are integrating equations from far out to the observer. So this Faraday rotation and Faraday conversion, you know, it happens along the line of sight. So what you see eventually is, you know, some net effect of all these rotations that happen on a wave. So it's not going to look the same here and here.
No,
so there's
if you look at just one line, the two here and the one at the left are just have the same kind of polarization angle, but the one in the middle, so I think
it's
should
scrambled.
Be some physical...
It's just totally scrambled because it's very Faraday thick. The Faraday thickness here, it's a million. So from one place to place, there's a huge, there may be a huge difference in the polarization angle. So it's just because it's very Faraday thick. That's why you don't see any organized structures anymore. It's just a polarization plane is just rotating like crazy, you know, like over 10 RG, it rotates a million times, 2 pi. So that's why you don't see any patterns here. It's completely scrambled.
Can you go to higher frequency?
Yeah, but you would have to go like to orders of magnitude higher, to maybe infrared, to actually start seeing some coherent signal. Because this Faraday rotation, it scales as 1 over frequency squared. So it at 230, 345, I think it still will be very scrambled. So, yeah.
So Omer made a prediction that you'll have lots of questions, and he was very correct. And most of the questions are because you gave a very stimulating talk and people have ideas and suggested to check this and that. So could you tell us how involved and time-consuming those type of calculations are? Can you...
Which one? GRMHD or...?
No, to produce the maps, the actual...
They are pretty expensive, yeah. I that's why I have to dump some of the work onto Jason because he has some better computer, but it takes... like day or 2 days to integrate one map in such a way that it will actually converge because those equations are stiff, so we have to, you know, the integration step has to be very, very small, and yeah, it takes time, and then we want to have nice map with high resolution,
many of those questions and checking this.
Maybe 2 days for one frame at the moment.
For a frame, okay. That should limit our imagination.
It took me a long time to make those movies.
Oliver, next.
I'm also surprised to see such a immense level of Faraday depolarization. And I'm wondering, the formula you showed where you have two angles at different wavelengths,
yeah.
And those are degenerate or only determined by a big U of 2 pi, you need a lot of frequency resolution to actually...
Yeah, so
get the RM. Do you do RM synthesis, and what's the how broad?
Yeah, we checked within maybe from 220 to 240 gigahertz. We have like 20 points maybe, and we see that more or less the results converge.
Okay. I mean, one possibility to break the degeneracy with the Faraday effects is to go really broad spectrum of frequencies. How broadband is the Event Horizon Telescope, and will SKA add into that? Or
I think it really depends because there are different telescopes, and it depends on which telescope is in the network. But I think ALMA has a little bit broader band than other telescopes, and I cannot...
But do you have a good understanding of the Faraday depth? At the current point, you mentioned there's this foreground screen, and there's a high Faraday depth in the source itself.
I just don't know. I don't know. I'm looking forward to see the data.
So from an observer's perspective, considering the data that we already have for Sedgwick star, where the structure that we're seeing appears to be even smaller than the black hole shadow, so people interpreted that maybe it's a hotspot or something. So going to M87, what if the profile of the millimeter brightness is, you know, along the jet, I mean, and you're seeing a knot somewhere further out, would you be able to resolve some structure that's further out and say that that's coming from the center of the jet?
So the size of your emission region depends on frequency, right? So at longer at lower energies, you see more extended emission, but once you move towards higher energies, the emission region shrinks down to this very compact region. And no matter, yeah, so I think these models are, the jet dominated models are pretty consistent with the current observations. So you always see this ring-like structure, which concentrates the emission to a very small region just near the horizon. So if you're asking me if this is consistent with current observations of MH7, it is very consistent. Yeah. It's the right size, smaller than the horizon too, so.
Okay, let's thank Monica again.